This is episode 4 of the Sales Change Podcast, and this is the one with Anthony Iannarino. He's the author of 3 best-selling sales books: Eat Their Lunch, Lost Art of Closing, and The Only Sales Guide You'll Ever Need. Honestly, I'm super impressed that we've got Anthony on the podcast. This is a fantastic episode. We talk about sales messaging during COVID-19. We talk about the 4 levels of value, how Anthony comes up with the ideas for his books, and we also answer the Sales Change 5 questions. Remember, if you want more information on the podcast, visit www.saleschange.co.uk/podcast. Subscribe to the newsletter. It'll be in your inbox at 9:45 every Monday morning. Enjoy the episode. Anthony Iannarino, welcome to the Sales Change audio experience. This is episode 4. How are you, my friend?
Episode 4?
Yeah, episode 4.
I should have been like a 1 or 100 or something.
Mike's number 1.
Mike was number 1?
Yeah, Victor Antonio's number 2.
How dare you, sir? How dare you? Mike and Victor.
And Larry Levine's number 3. So you're awesome. You've got a hard act to follow, let's put it that way.
I'm batting cleanup now, huh?
How are you? How's life treating you?
Very well.
Yeah? How's the corona situation where you are?
In Ohio, we shut down early, and we stayed locked up for something close to 90 days or something like that.
Yeah.
And it was always under very strong control here. And it's now, so there's a thing called the RT rate, like how fast does it transmit? If you're a 1 or over, you're spreading.
Yeah.
And we're something like a 0.85 or something like that now. So we're under the 1.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's starting to come under control.
Yeah, there's certain pockets in the UK which are heading above the R rate, we call it in the UK, above 1. Thankfully, and I'm touching the desk now, touch wood, we're not in that situation. There's no local lockdown here, but it's crazy.
That's because you're not in London.
We're not. Yeah, and to be fair, where we are in the UK, in Bournemouth, we've got a lovely beach in Bournemouth, and we get a lot of tourists, we get a lot of holidaymakers come down. And where the weather went crazy maybe 3 weeks ago, and the beach was just rammed with people. It was like nothing had ever happened. The beach was just rammed. So the local council took the decision of literally the police were closing the beaches. You can't come. You can't visit the area. And thankfully, we didn't see that growth of the R rate. But, man, it's just mad.
Well, I think that, you know, I'm here in America, and we had to break off from you. But I think the part of the British culture that we kept is something that you might call oppositional defiance disorder, you know, and the more you try to impose your will on us, the more defiant we become. And there's some of that going on here too.
So how's business? Did you see a drop off in business over that period, or have you, I hate the word pivot, but have you pivoted?
No, I mean, I don't, there's a whole bunch of us that really didn't have to do any pivoting. I mean, we were already doing the things that we were doing, and it moved to virtual.
Yeah.
And everyone accepted it, moved to virtual. There wasn't a bunch of like cancellations on things where you could still do it over Zoom or something like that. So there wasn't much of a pivot. And, you know, the United States economy dropped 32.9% in the second quarter, but it looks like a V-shaped recovery. There's a lot of activity right now. There's a lot going on. If it wasn't for, you know, the loss of things like restaurants and bars that couldn't survive this, it'd probably be a little bit better than it is now. But we're on our way back.
Do you feel it as well? Because salespeople feel when activity's picking back up.
Well, I don't know if all of them do. So it's when you start talking about large groups of people, there's going to be a bell curve. The very first thing that happened when the pandemic hit was I started getting phone calls and emails and LinkedIn messages saying, should I stop selling? And totally the wrong question. That's not the right question to ask anyway. And a better question would be like, how do I approach this now? That would be a better question to ask. But that wasn't the question that people were asking. And I always go back to first principles. So I'm a values-based, principle-driven person. So I tend to think through a certain lens. But the lens is, what do we do when we're selling? We go out and we help people solve what they might consider intractable problems, and we help them get better results than they could get without us.
Yeah.
And whether it's man-made, like the closing down the economy, or if it's a natural disaster like COVID, when people are struggling, our job is to go help them get better results and right their ship. I mean, that's it. So the only way a sales organization can right their own ship is by helping right other people's ships. So like, why would you ever decide to withdraw from the primary thing that salespeople do? And if you can help people in good times, well, then you're damn well obligated to help them in bad times. I mean, you can't just go and say, looks like you're doing really good, now I want your money. Yeah. You know, you got to go in and do the heavy lifting part when they're suffering and it's not easy to get those results. So that was the advice that I started to give right away, was like, look, you have an obligation. You've got to go out and do this work.
I think that's where leaders are made as well, though, especially within the sales teams. When coronavirus hit our company in the UK, the overriding questions from all of my staff were job related, whether they're going to have a job, whether they were going to be safe, whether their livelihoods were going to continue. And I think as a leader, you've got to address the human concerns. Larry said it perfectly in the last podcast, that selling from the heart. So you've got to address internal customers. You've got to make sure that your staff are safe and they feel loved and they feel warm. And then they're able to give back to the customers because they know they've got that sense of security. So when we had the coronavirus hit in the UK, the first thing we did, or the first thing that I did, was to assess the cash flow, make sure that the business could survive past a certain point. Once we've understood the cash flow and we've got enough profit, we worked out the raw numbers. How much did we need to do in order to get past point X? And then hopefully, when we get to point X, the economy starts to recover. And fingers crossed, it's starting to look that way because we've had an uptake in sales. We did our largest order month for 3 years last month. So things are on the right way up. But I think you've got to take control and understand that in order to empower your team, you've got to take responsibility for how you manage them and how you care for them.
Agreed. I also think that when you try to go inside and connect with yourself, that's where you start to get anxiety. That's where you start to get a disempowered mindset. When you start looking at all the things that are going on that are outside of your control. And if you focus and say, instead of thinking about what's outside of my control, I'm going to direct my attention, what is in my control? So can you pick up the phone and call and check on your customers? Well, if you're doing that, then you're not thinking about you anymore. You're thinking about other people. Yeah. And can you go out and find the people that have the kind of problems that you solve and see what you can do to help them find their way through this? As soon as you start to get rid of the self-orientation and move to an other orientation, things get easier for you because you're not in your head going, I'm worried, I've got this anxiety, I don't know, you know. But you're either going to live in the past and think about, well, I should have, and regrets, or in the future, well, I don't know how it's going to be, so I'm anxious. Or you just go with right now, what can I do? And when you start deciding what you can do and that you can make a difference for other people, all the other stuff sort of fades away. Yeah. And the more that you can just focus on, what do I need to do? And it's always external. I mean, you always have to take action to help other people in selling. I mean, what else is there to do?
Exactly. Exactly.
Get out of your email box. Stop watching cat videos or UFC videos, whatever it is that you like.
Mine's
that.
The NFL. The NFL, we don't get 24-hour coverage of the NFL in the UK. So it's catching up through the NFL channels on Facebook. That's my biggest weakness.
There you go. Yeah. I understand it. Like we don't have college football right now where I am. They're talking about not having it. And I think it's our birthright to have
it. It should be one of the football amendments. Yeah.
It should absolutely be an amendment. Like, you cannot touch college football. It's too pure and we need it. But there's a big fight going on to try to bring it back.
When people messaged you, Anthony, and said, should we continue selling? What was your advice? How have you continued to sell? Have you just reached out to your clients and just said, listen, I'm still here. I'm still able to provide you with solutions. Or have you just taken a deeper approach and just said, listen, any problem, let me help you solve it?
No, we pretty much are focused on what we do. Yeah. And we just continue to do that. And I've been doing this for, I've got to be at least 2 to 3 years older than you, maybe more. I don't know, maybe a bit more. There's never a time to stop selling. There's never a time to stop doing the things that you have to do to build a sales organization and to grow sales. There's not. So keep doing the same thing. The need on the other end for what I do never changes. I mean, it maybe gets more critical in something like this because you're not sure how to have the conversations. And so a lot of it was, you know, we immediately did two courses. The first course we did was a recovery plan. And it was about how to take action on your clients, your past clients, and your prospective clients in a pandemic.
Yeah.
And the second course we did was how to overcome the objections that you're going to get when people are in the middle of a pandemic and how you have to operate to be able to still get meetings.
That's a really valuable course, how to overcome those objections.
Yeah, we did those two right out of the gate. We did a live version of it. We did a recording version of it. And we did that just because we knew that that was the need right now.
Yeah.
Kind of like Jeb, you know, he did the virtual selling because he knew it was a need right now. I'm not particularly interested in virtual selling, so I'm happy he did it because I don't want to answer those questions. I'm happy that Jeb did.
Yeah.
I haven't written a prospecting book because Jeb already wrote one. You know, I don't have to do that because he's already covered that ground, and that's fine. But I was more interested in just what's the action plan going forward. So that's the work that I did, was how do you immediately take massive action and start to right everybody else's ship so you can get yours straightened out? And then how do you have those conversations? Because that was the tricky part for most people. It's the execution.
You don't want to appear that you're trying to sell, do you? I had a conversation with somebody, and I hate the word salesy really like sends shivers up my spine. I hate the word salesy because that's not how salespeople should make people feel. They should just feel like they're building a relationship with somebody and you're having a problem solved. Exactly what you said at the start of the conversation. When customers feel like they're being sold to, that's when they immediately switch off. And I'm sure you've seen it in the US, because we saw it in the UK, but huge firms, major firms, when they change their advertising style to say, we're here for you, we're still open, we're still trading, banks did it, supermarkets did it.
Everybody did it,
but it was a rush. And I think the message then just got lost because everybody just pivoted and said, we're here for you, we're still open. And it just appears desperate. I don't know if you feel the same, because yes, the message is right. We're still here to help you. But when everybody's saying the same message, it just gets lost.
I don't even really understand the message. We're here for you. In what way? Are you paying my mortgage? I'm on unemployment. You're going to pick up my car payment. How are you here for me? You sell cookies. Like they're not really here for you. That was what you do when you don't have anything to say. And I have a client in marketing communications, and about, I don't know, 4 weeks of that, and their client started saying, We can't say this. Like, we have to say something better than this. But what you can say in sales is, we've been working with our existing client base, and we found that there's a few things that we've done that have helped them start to generate more revenue, increase their profitability, reduce some of their cost structures. And because they've had to furlough people and lay them off, it's been really, really helpful for them. Would you give me 20 minutes to share with you what we see right now? And even if there's not a next step for us, you'll know what you might be thinking about as this moves forward, and you'll know how we think about it if you decide you need help. I mean, it's
that's
not hard to do.
That's a lovely opener. Yeah, I want to pick up the phone and speak to you now.
You're like, what does he know? There could be helpful.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's it. So what could be helpful? And the truth is, many of the companies that I work with, we're doing just that. Like, we have some ideas about helping you.
Yeah.
And that's how the economy comes back, is we engage with each other. We start solving problems. You know, I've got one that this company furloughed all their people and they couldn't do the work anymore, but they needed to do the work. And it turned out to be a huge outsourcing project for them that reduced the overall cost. It turned a fixed cost into a variable cost. And this company now is in a better position because somebody called and said, I think we can help you. If you think I have to sell something, you know, then you're going to behave in a certain way.
Yeah.
And if you think my job is to go help them get a better result, just the shift in intentions helps most salespeople be better salespeople.
100%. I'll tell you what, one of your books, and it's just on the shelf behind me, Eat Their Lunch, that book has helped me no end. I always bang on social media that Mike Weinberg's book changed my career, because Sales Management Simplified really just shook up my career and allowed me to go to the next level. But Eat Their Lunch has helped me in so many different situations, I'm not going to lie. The amount of times the valve industry is cutthroat, it's discount driven, everybody discounts, everybody looks for the bottom line. And depending on which market you're selling into, so the Far East will literally rinse any element of profit from any sale, compared to, let's say, the Western market, where profit is king and you can try and negotiate back and forth. But Eat Their Lunch has given me so many tools in order to capture areas of market. How did you come up with the idea of the book? What's your creative process behind your books?
I've only written three books. I'm writing the fourth book right now. The first book I wrote because no one had written a competency model for B2B sales. Like there just wasn't a competency model. And the thinking about the character traits, or what I called mindset in that book, get left out. You know, they're like, Jimmy sucks at prospecting. And it's like, no, Jimmy, he's good at prospecting. He has no discipline and he doesn't do any prospecting. He is actually good at it, though. Yeah. You know, and so you start to look at through a different lens. And the lens you're looking at is, what are they missing? You know, and if you have a team, you know this, you have reps who are dependent. And they're just going to come and go, Matt, here's the situation. What should I do? I got four kids at home. I don't need another. I need you thinking about what you need to do. And then you bring me the idea and we'll riff about it. But I'm not just going to sit here and tell you how to do your job. You got to think on this kind of a job. That's how it is.
That's what we pay you for.
Right. I need you to be an independent because I got four dependents at home.
Yeah.
And thankfully, you figured out how this keeps happening, so you're not going to have eight babies at some point in time. And
no more, trust me, honestly.
Remake the world in your image or something. I'm not sure what you're working on over
there. It's like the Matrix in my house. Do you know when he keeps replicating?
that one I wrote because no one had done it, and I wanted people to know that the all the attributes and skills that it takes to be a good salesperson, there's a lot of them, you know, and I wrote a post about maybe a month ago of all the things that I left out of that. I mean, I have 10 more chapters for that book.
You're going to do a volume two. You should do a volume two.
Maybe just re-release it with an extended version at some point in the future. So the second book, The Lost Art of Closing, all the closing books are tie-down, smarmy words that you wouldn't want to use. Like, Matt, do you want that sweatshirt in white or in blue?
Yeah. Like, there's the option close.
Yeah. It's just,
can we start next Monday or next Wednesday?
Yeah. That is the either or, alternative of choice close. Like that's just not how you sell now, and you don't have to. I mean, the buyers are sophisticated, they know what you're doing. There's no reason to do that. But what I recognized was that there was no one who has had the conversation since Neil Rackham in Spin Selling, where he said there's either a close and you have a transactional buy and you should just ask, or you're in a complex sale and you've got to get a whole bunch of commitments.
Yeah.
And no one had written down what those commitments might look like. So I wrote my view of 10 commitments so that people could understand you've got to link the commitments together. So at the time I wrote that, there were a lot of people saying, never be closing, never be closing. Let the client tell you what comes next. Like, bad idea.
Yeah, the client doesn't know.
The client doesn't know.
That's what your job is.
That I'm supposed to know. They're not supposed to know. Like, I'm supposed to be helping them through this process. So I wrote that just because I was so frustrated with the never be closing. Like, if people took that advice, they would have a pipeline full of every deal being stalled. I mean, it makes no sense at all to do that. So I wrote that one just because I wanted to straighten that out and have the final word in the argument. And the final word is, you better get a commitment to every conversation you need down the whole path.
The commitment that I took away from that book was the micro commitment. So after every single meeting, make sure that there's a micro commitment and you know when you're going to follow up. That's what I do in every single interaction now.
Yeah.
And when it becomes habit and when it becomes second nature, honestly, the client doesn't realize that you're doing it. I know that they're written down in their actions that you should take away, but the client doesn't realize that, vice versa. The client doesn't go to a objection school. They don't go to a school where they learn how to object, just like we don't go to a school to learn how to close unless you read lots of books. But the micro commitment one is the one that I took away from that book. Massive, massive game changer.
Yeah, it helps tremendously to control the process. The third book actually is the oldest content I have. The idea of level four, I created in 2011. I mean, so that was a long time ago. The first book came out in 2016.
Yeah.
And then that book came out in 2018. So it was a long time before I could write it. But the way that I thought about what I was doing was give people the competency model, teach them to be more consultative by being able to control the process, and then teach them the more what I would call, you know, eat their lunch isn't a 110 college class. That's like that's your capstone you know, your senior thesis in grad school kind of approach. And I didn't think that it was fair to put that first, because I think if you didn't have the other two books to lean on, it would be harder to execute.
Yeah.
So that's why I did it in that order. About, look, we live in a commoditized world. You're going to have insights. You're going to have to be able to nurture relationships. You're going to have to create some sort of differentiated, compelling value that's not easy to do. Because, Matt, I know something about you. You sell valves.
Yeah.
So you have a valve. Somebody else has a valve. If I were to set them on a table, you could sell either valve. And it wouldn't be hard to tell the difference.
Like, exactly that.
I mean, you would go like, wait, I can sell either one of these valves. I know how to sell valves. But because that's true, then the way that you sell, how you sell, starts to become the differentiator in winning and losing.
Yeah.
And when you create more value for people, you create a preference to work with you. And that book straightens all that kind of stuff out for people.
And just from that book, it was the openings, how you can leverage the value, the four, you've got four levels of value, haven't you? But how you can leverage the four levels of value in order to differentiate yourself between your competitors. So like you say, two valve sellers, if I'm telling them where the valve industry is going and what their valve is going to be used for and how it's going to react, and then what the next, you can't see it on the shelves behind me, but I've got two prototype materials. So two brand new plastics, which we're developing that have never been seen in the valve market before. If I can tell my clients about that rather than, oh, this is just a plastic valve, that instantly captures their imagination. And it goes down to the storytelling as well, doesn't it? Because when you create the story behind your brand and who you are and where you're coming from, you become their hero. And then you're able to interact and have a relationship with them way easier than Joe Bloggs, who's selling.
Nancy Duarte, who wrote a book called Slideology and a book called Resonance, both great books. She would argue that you're not the hero. The client is the hero. You're Yoda. They're Luke Skywalker.
And
like, I'm the one that's going to tell you how to use the force. And the force in this case is a new plastic valve that's more sturdy and more durable, is going to last longer, is easier to install. All of those things. And it's going to lighten up, you know, whatever, wherever it's going is going to be lighter because of the, like, the whole bunch of things. Like, the
you could sell valves, Anthony. You sound like one of my sales guys.
once you know how to sell, it's not that hard. But, you know, you're trying to, what's the strategic outcome? Do they need it to be lighter? Do they need it to be easier to install? Do they get the time back of not having to adjust these things? But there's some strategic value that translates into, it's going to be more profitable for you. It's going to help you generate greater revenue. It's going to help your
less
client have lighter. Whatever those things are. And then you turn it into money and say, this is why it's worth paying 14 cents more for our valve.
I sell valves for a living, correct. But I've only been doing this for 2 years. I took the job and I knew nothing about the valve industry. But what I do know is how to build relationships and move a product, exactly what you're saying. So I could go into a mobile phone shop. I could go into, I'm trying to think, curtains or sell monitors from a computer store. I would do exactly what I did when I first started selling valves, which is I set up Google alerts on my computer that told me information about our key clients. I set up Google alerts for industry and news to do with, so our valves are used in shipping containers and John Deere is one of our main clients. So I'd set up Google alerts for that, because then when I know the news quicker than the employees of the company know the news, then I can tell them what's happening. It makes me appear that I am in touch with their industry and with their company. As soon as I started, I created Google alerts for all of these companies, all of the industry news, and then started emailing my clients and picking up the phone to them and speaking to them and saying, did you know this? Did you know this? Not just on a repetitive basis, but just so that I could, and I hate the word checking in, but so that I could have a conversation with them and make them aware that I'm still here. But that just builds that familiarity. And then when I'm having a meeting with people in John Deere just outside of Chicago, they love it because they know who I am and I found out about the business. I know what they're trying to trial. I know what they're trying to do. And it's just about getting all of that information in one place and having it in your armory.
Right. That's right. You have to know things now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, sales people used to show up and here's a catalog of valves. What can you use? You know, now you got to say, listen, this is where the industry's going. This is why the industry's going there. These are the demands that their clients are telling us that they're making. And this is how we're responding to help them do this more profitably. I mean, you can't be a know-nothing anymore. You know, it's not good enough that you've got a smile on your face and a shine on your shoes and a catalog in your briefcase. It's like that isn't how we sell now. You actually have to be somebody who knows more than your prospective client or your client. So you're an industry expert. They're not. They buy what you sell. So on that bridge where the two businesses come together, you have to be the expert. You know, and I get a lot of pushback when I teach my Building Insights course, where people say, well, I'll never know as much about their business as they do. Right. You don't need to. They do. You need to know how your business helps them and what they need to know about the thing that they buy from you. That's the part where you have to know more than they do. And you're not selling to a company that sells valves. You're the company that makes the valves. So they don't know as much about valves because they buy a valve. They don't make a valve and sell it to 10,000 companies. You know, it's very, very different. One of us has way more experience knowing all the different ways and all the different choices that people can make to solve a problem. And the other one has a problem they're trying to find somebody who can help them solve.
Exactly.
That's how it works.
For sure. For sure. We're just coming up to the end of the podcast, Anthony. And what I do on every single episode is ask the same five questions at the end. And I'm going to ask the same five to you. They were on the prep sheet that I sent you. I'm hoping you've read it.
I haven't, but I don't need it.
Okay. What was the last book that you read?
The last book I read is sitting right on my desk right here, Depth Psychology in the New Ethic by Eric Neumann, who was Carl Jung's greatest student. And it's a particularly difficult book to read. It's a small book, and apparently it's not his best book, but I ended up picking the wrong book first. I should have picked the one that came after, because apparently that's a clearer book than this one, but I gained a lot. It's a lot about how your subconscious and unconscious mind drive most of your beliefs and behaviors. Very, very useful right now.
What was the worst sales mistake that you've ever made?
Early on, I would trust people to do what they said they were going to do. And so I had a verbal commitment from a client after having five meetings. And I was supposed to pick the contract up on Monday, and I got a call saying, we went with your competitor. And I just left on Friday with a verbal. I'm supposed to sign a contract on Monday, and I get a call that he already signed a contract with my competitor. And I never asked if there were other options that he was exploring. I never asked, you know, why he didn't sign the contract right there. I was young, and I just didn't know. And I lost a $2 million deal. Because I had no control over the process and no real commitment, although I thought I had a commitment. And I didn't check to see if he had concerns. Ultimately...
Were you blinded by the lights? Is that what it was? Were you blinded by the fact that, oh my God, I've got this? Or was it just naivety?
When everything goes perfectly the whole way through, you just have such confidence. I didn't know there was even another horse in the race because it never came up. And... He basically told me, I liked something that they had that you didn't tell me about, and I think it's really important. And I said, it's not, and it won't be for you. and I will see you in a few months when this doesn't work out. 6 months later, I got the account because the choice that he made was wrong. I was right the whole time, but I didn't do a good job. I didn't do a good job locking down the commitments with him as I went through this because it was just so easy. And you still always have to do the right thing, even when you think you don't have to do the right thing. You're like, I think I'm okay.
Yeah.
You might not be okay. Check and see if you're okay. And don't be naive and don't make mistakes that you could easily correct by having a conversation.
100%. I had a similar experience where we were the incumbent provider and all the works went out to tender. And I thought, oh yeah, we've got this for sure because we've written the tender. We know exactly what we're supplying. We know what the price points are. We know how long things take. But when you know how long things take, that works against you because then somebody else will price it so it's cheaper because they don't know how long it takes. So instantly, the other client went with the cheaper version. We lost out on price. But again, 6-7 months later, we won the contract back because they couldn't fulfill it for the price that they were being paid for it. So,
see, and this is an important concept to understand that most salespeople don't spend enough time thinking about. They were cheaper, but they had the higher cost.
Correct.
Yeah, and you got to understand that cost and price are not the same thing. So, because when you fail and you don't have what you want, there's a cost to that.
Correct. What did you want to be when you grew up?
A rock star.
Did you?
Still do.
Do you play in a band now?
No, but I'm. I sometimes get together with some guys and play, but I don't have a band right now.
Yeah.
I would like to. I already.
What would the band be called, Anthony? Let's get into it. What would the band be called?
The band right now, I just put it on Twitter last week. It would probably be called Bobby Babylon and the Brutes or something like that. Yeah.
What type of music is it?
I played rock and roll when I was a kid. I played rock and roll from the time I was 15 until I was about 26 or 27.
Yeah.
And I still like it. I wish I could play. I'm the last time I got together with all the guys I played with, I mean, I used to be the strongest performer in the group. Like I had a 3-octave range. I could sing anything. And then I showed up and everybody got better and I got terrible. So now I have, I hope I have 1 octave. I may not even have that. Like my range is like this big now. It's very hard. I can still do a good Bon Scott, but beyond that, I don't have many chops left.
What's the worst job that you could ever do and why?
I don't know what the worst job is. I can tell you, for me personally, any job where I had to take direction from someone else and I wasn't allowed to use my creativity, my resourcefulness, and my initiative,
yeah,
would be a certain type of hell for me.
See, I'm a former military man, and that what you're describing is the 9 years that I did in the British Army.
Yeah.
And that's probably why I left, because then as soon as I left, I was able to find me, because you're essentially told to be something.
So pick up a book called The Art of Action, and it's by Stephen Bungay, B-U-N-G-A-Y. And then if you've not read Von Moltke's work, Von Moltke was a Prussian general.
Okay.
Von Moltke worried about was initiative. And there's a great book called Fighting Power. I can't think of the author. It'll come to me as soon as we hang up. But ultimately, when the Allies tried to fight the Germans, every German soldier was worth 2.5 Allied soldiers. And it was because of the Prussian culture. And the Prussian culture was, once you know what your mission is, you need to know the mission above you, below you, and to the sides of you. And then if your commanders are killed in battle, you keep going because you know what your mission is. And the Allies, it was wait for instructions. Waiting for instructions was not a good idea. And it took Patton to start to recognize that. But what the idea of mission control now is that I'm giving you the outcome. And then you have a whole range of motion inside there that you have to come up with. And that... I study that because I think it's what you want from salespeople. I need your initiative. I need your resourcefulness. I need your creativity. I need you to think on these things. And that's the way modern militaries run now, is with something called mission command. There's a number of books you can read on that, too, that are very useful.
I'm definitely going to check out that Stephen Bungay one, The Art of Action. But that's what I do. In my sales team now, I love having the target number. The target number, where we need to be at the end of the year, because that's our mission. And then I'm very good at getting all of my troops to follow that mission and get across that line. And then we have additional missions after that. So once we've hit that, we hit our 10% and then we hit our 20%. So everybody's got a mission. But for sure, the military has definitely helped me nail down those processes so that I know that I can get X, Y, and Z person to hit this target. And that's all it's about. It's just a single-minded focus on that's the goal. The last question on the podcast, Anthony, is which leader do you look up to the most?
Which leader do I look up to the most?
We try and stay away from political.
That category has to be thrown out.
Yeah,
right on, at the beginning, you have to throw that out. If you're looking for good leadership, you don't look to politicians.
Yeah,
so that is an easy one.
We have had one answer, which was a politician, which was the New Zealand president, Jacinda Ardern, because of how she coped with the coronavirus and what she did in order to sort of instill a positive vibe around the country and move them from one stage to the next. So that's the only political leader that we've had.
Well, then I'll add a second one, Marcus Aurelius. So, nice. Yeah, the Stoic philosopher and Caesar,
yeah,
who was a philosopher king. and who was fair-minded and who was concerned about the future of the people that he led. So I'll go with Marcus Aurelius.
Thank you very much.
Under duress, because, you know, I don't know, that's a tough one.
It is a tough one, and that's, I mean, we've had what answers have we had? We've had Muhammad Ali, we've had Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, all of the great leaders that have been throughout the times. But there's also been like personal, like great leaders. So somebody who's severely impacted on somebody's career, they've also included those. So it doesn't have to be a famous leader. It could be just any leader. But so where can people find more information from you, Anthony?
Best place to find me is thesalesblog.com, and I publish there daily. And the best way to probably follow the most important work I do is by signing up for the Sunday newsletter, and that's thesalesblog.com/newsletter.
I follow that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony.